Let's come to the fourth presentation of a series, which is a set. It's a resonant set that has a 13th presentation that calibrates it from a resonant set to a harmonic. Once we are able to secure for ourselves a harmonic, the entirety of the art of music and poetry, of dance and all the pictorial arts, painting, architecture, sculpture, become available to us. A harmonic allows us to have an art. And as we're appreciating, art is prismatic. It does not merely sum up, but it's like a lens which has been tapered and shaped to give an accuracy of vision which is wider than simply perception, which is more encompassing than conception. And we're coming to appreciate that vision is a dimension. Like time, or like the three dimensions of space, vision is a dimension. It is a fifth dimension. And its dimension is such that forms can emerge within it, processes can have their currents within it, and so it functions for us in our appreciation of it as a field. The field of vision is the field of consciousness, and thus consciousness is a dimension. It is a dimension that has a different quality from the dimensions of space-time. Space-time always makes a cycle which comes together, which presents most archetypally unities, and that those unities can be of any size, but they occur phenomenally because they are discrete. They are discrete because they emerge within a field that has no numeration. Our traditional way of speaking of that field is that it is nature. But the honed understanding is that that field is a field of a zero, a fertile zero quality that allows within that zero for ones to occur that are distinct because they are surrounded by the zeroness, and thus they are phenomenal. They are quanta. And though they can combine, and however it is that they combine, they are quantized, they can be measured. And one of the characteristics of their measurability is their stability out of the zero field, and they maintain that stability by a symmetry. Initially, our conception of it was a symmetry of charge. Not just positive and negative, but the early pairs in that symmetry were thought of both east and west. The Pythagorean communities 2,500 years ago began your instruction by presenting you with pairs of opposites. Cold and hot, moist and dry. And some of these pairs then paired together so that in this case, moist and dry, cold and hot, became a square of a frame of reference for phenomenality that can be changed by unhooking the polarity which keeps them in opposite stability. And that the key to it was to shift the polarity 90 degrees, 90 degrees left or right. In which case, the polarity entered into a flow of exchange and became a complementarity. The charges did not merge into one. They transformed into a pair that were in a complementarity, which then could be shifted back 90 degrees either way into a new polarity, into a new stability. And east and west, this became the technique of alchemy. Not an esoteric technique per se, but a technique that was applied especially to metals and metallurgy and metalwork. They knew nothing of the thermionic emissivity of molten metals, but they knew that if you heat copper with a couple of percent of tin, the new metal will be bronze. And if you vary that, instead of using tin, if you use zinc with the copper and a couple of other little smidgens, you will get brass. The first time that metallurgy achieved this kind of alchemical changing of the metal was the beginning of the Bronze Age. And it took everyone by surprise, because with bronze, you can get a very sharp point. And all of a sudden, the capacity for man to understand that he could transform by a vision that could be put into a technique. And so the master artisan who was taught the vision and the technique became capable of doing a very specific measurement and making a recipe of how you do this. The recipe was sometimes very long and involved because it was discovered, for instance, in Japan, that if you fold transformed metal and you refold it and keep refolding it, the layers of the transformed metal will stack up and will not only give you a sharp edge, it will give you a suppleness to the metal. And so the samurai sword is made of hundreds of times of folding the different lattice levels of the metal, and each time the technique is accompanied by a silent or sometimes vocal chanting of the formula, so that one goes through the ritual application of the technique through the mythic story line of the language, brought together, integrated by the symbolic structure of thought, but all of this surrounded by a visionary consciousness which was not integral. And the huge surprise was that consciousness is a complementarity to integral. We commonly use the term differential, in that not only was there a vision field of differential consciousness, which was complementary to the zero integral field of nature, but that it changed by exchange the very structures of symbolic thought. The field of differential consciousness is distinguished by the capacity for remembering. The structure of symbolic thought in its integral is distinguished by having a part of it called the imagination, by which images can be ordered, and the language of those images with the concomitant feelings can be ordered, and one can get a very stable, complex structure, which we sometimes call the idea, but the real instrument, the real part of the structure of thought that fed the information, the data, was the imagination. When there is a complementarity, not only does the field of differential consciousness weave with the field, the zero field of integral nature, but it exchanges its remembering center function with the central function of the structure of symbolic thought, which is the imagination. And when the imagination goes into the differential field, it becomes creative imagining. And when remembering goes into the structure of thought, it becomes the memory. So now you have an interesting do-si-do where creative imagining and remembering flow together, and out of this comes the insight extended in the play of materials and experience and possible compositions, and art is born. And the first time that our species developed art was about 50,000 years ago. And our refined transform at that time gave us almost a new species. And the traditional way in scientific language for several hundred years, ever since Linnaeus, is to refer to this transform miracle by doubling the last Latin word in our species. The original species was Homo sapiens, around apparently from DNA studies and archaeological, paleontological work, since 200,000 years ago in Africa. And 150,000 years later, the species transformed to Homo sapiens sapiens. Not only a wise hominid, but wise about being wise, and used art then to initiate those that needed to be initiated into the visionary field, and showed that in that complementarity, it could be cinched in such a way that the new forms that came out were prismatic forms that could operate in a pragmatic cycle. And we see from Paleolithic art the earliest cave paintings in southern France at Cosquer go back to about 35,000 years ago. The earliest sculptures in what is today Germany go back to about 32,000 years ago. Right away one finds interesting ways of art being used to bring people through, keeping the flow of experience and teaching it that the flow of experience can flow both ways. It can flow from the phenomena, or it can flow back to the phenomena and change the phenomena. And it changes them by bringing the mnemonic structure of symbols and the creative imagining of vision into play like a focus to give each aspect of the polarities the 90-degree shift left or right. The word that is used for left or right here is chirality, which is also symmetrical, and chirality has to do with magnetism. Polarization has to do with electricity. And so chirality also can be cinched in such a way that you can have north and south magnetic poles, which are a pair of opposites, which are a polarity, which can be transformed by shifting it again 90 degrees so that the 90 degree angle became a most important way to understand something about the equilibrium of opposites that allowed for transformation to give it a different order of equilibrium. The strongest mnemonic that was ever developed on this planet was by Pythagoras, who said, if you take a 90 degree angle of a certain length and join the ends of those lengths with a third line, you have a triangle which is indicative of the ability to transform. If you have three little blocks up and four little blocks across, and you join them, you get five little blocks as the third line, the hypotenuse of the triangle, with a 90 degree angle. If you square the three little blocks, you get nine of them. If you square the four little blocks, you get 16 of them. And if you square the five little blocks, you get 25 of them. 3 plus 16 equals 25. So that now you have the way to understand something that is visionarily extremely powerful. Because it is arbitrary to have just two lines at 90 degrees. Because if you cross two lines, you actually get four sets of 90 degrees. You get a full four. And so you can have a right angle triangle four different ways. And the ancient wisdom way of presenting it was to use the hand, that the thumb is the fifth dimension of consciousness, and the four fingers are the four dimensions of space-time, and you can present it, you can reverse it, you can inverse it, and inverse that. And so now, if you have two human beings, with each with a pair of hands, those four hands together can be given in such a way that they cover the full range of possibilities of transform. And now one has a very refined sense where Homo sapiens sapiens began to understand, if you are able to teach yourself prismatically the entire spectrum of what is possible, now you have a chance for something which you hadn't even thought of before, and now the thought comes pressing that you can not only have a harmonic, but you can have a harmonic analysis. And the essence of science is the ability to have a harmonic analysis, to be able to understand that in this full spectrum that includes electricity and, can we call it, magneticity, and maybe some other properties or qualities or processes, that one can really expand oneself now in such a way that there is no perimeter, there's no integral. And recursively, this is the mathematical term, recursively one begins to understand, and around the time of Pythagoras, the historical human being who perfected this understanding was the historical Buddha. That obviously then, what surrounds all phenomena is a non-phenomenal field that doesn't register, so that all phenomena really can be brought back to just a singleness, and that singleness can be reabsorbed by the zero field so that its phenomenality its individuality, its singularity will be absorbed and vanish, leaving just the zero field. The historical Buddha called this the non-me, the non-I. That all unities are composite, at least of an initial polarity. And when that polarity is transformed so that it is a free flow complementarity, nothing remains. There's nothing left over. Yet the zero-ness that remains, that emptiness, is not a negative emptiness. That would be to carry over the habit of polarizing. It's not negative at all. It is free. And so the way that was talked about was that this is a freedom. And that freedom does something transformative to the sense of time. Not only space, because space in its phenomenality collapses to a singleness. The Sanskrit word is ekagrata. One is holding singleness, which can vanish. Not only does space then vanish, but time itself vanishes, but leaves a super awareness in place where there was time before. And the sense of present vanishes, and what comes into not phenomenal, but like a noumenal quality is that of presence. The best description I ever heard of it, read of it, was at the age of 95, the old Japanese Zen master D.T. Suzuki was asked by Richard DiMartino. Suzuki was lecturing in Oaxaca with Eric Fromm and DiMartino and a number of people. They did a book on it together. And he said, well, what was your first experience like of this awakening to presence, pure? And he said, it was a situation where I had become invited as a young man, because I knew English, to go to Chicago in the late 1890s, invited by a man named Paul Karas, a German who had immigrated to the United States, to Chicago, which was growing at the time, leaps and bounds. And he founded a new philosophic school and publishing house, which he called the Open Court. And he asked the Zen master of D.T. Suzuki, Shoyin Shaku, to send me someone who knows the Zen tradition well enough that he will be able to look back not just for Japanese Zen, but to the origins of it in China for Chinese Zen, and that the origins of Chinese Zen go all the way back to Lao Tzu, to the Tao Te Ching. Kara said, I need someone who can translate the Tao Te Ching from the Chinese so that the translation can be read so that we can understand in English not only the Chinese origins of Zen, but the Japanese refinement and developments of Zen so that we can have an English language Zen. And D.T. Suzuki was chosen. He was 20 years old. He was a real genius. Shoyin Shaku said, just because you know the languages, just because you know the traditions and the history, doesn't mean a thing, because you don't know how not to know. And if you cannot have a hyper experience of the fertile zero-ness, called in Japanese Satori, you cannot go. Not only can you not go, you must commit harakiri. You have to kill yourself, because you've been given every talent, you've inherited every opportunity, and you know all of it, but you have never done it. So he said, I give you a few days. The boat leaves in 4 days. You have until the boat leaves. You'll either leave fertile with the zero-ness, or you will be dead by your own hand. And the 20-year-old just went at it and went at it and went at it. And of course, this is a traditional wisdom story. Nothing worked. He knew every aspect of it. It didn't happen. So he resigned himself to the fact that that was it. And as soon as he did that, he said it was like everything vanished. And the very next picosecond, it was all there again. And he said it was a peculiar experience because he went to the Zendo door and he opened it and he said everything was transparent. The trees were transparent. The buildings were transparent. He could look through them. And he looked down at his own body and he said, I was transparent too. That transparency, that openness, is when the fifth dimension of consciousness comes into free play in the four dimensions, not of space-time. That's a conceptual turning the cart before the horse. Time is the first dimension. And instead of there being a present where phenomenality is opaque, one has a presence where noumenality is transparent. The current cliche of talking about a transparency in government is the gibberish of grade school children. They don't get it because they've never gotten it in such a way that it's real. So our first, second, third, and infinite task is to educate them to become real and to live transparently, actually. Then you won't need to struggle with political economic structures. You will know how to do life in such a way that it works. That's what all this is about. The quality of the historical Buddha was the last integral that he had was a moment, the present one moment of thought. And of course, he, being one of the most powerful yogis ever to live on any planet, he ground even finer and went subatomic on the moment of thought and found, as we said last week, that it had 16 parts. Seemingly 16 parts, but only 8 of them were discrete because they had zeroness in between them. The other 8 did not have zero in between them. What it had in between them was infinity. Not only does zero not have any perimeter, but can emerge phenomenality, the infinite does not emerge phenomenality out of its non-perimeterness. It emerges whole spectra in cascades of possibility. And so the Buddha saw, not only is there the ability to take one back into its absorption into the zero field, but one could take the entire spectrum into its play in the non-perimeter infinite field of possibilities. The simple way to talk about this is that in the phenomenal world, you can have astronomy. In the differential world, you can have astrophysics. The photon is phenomenal in the cycle of nature, but it is prismatic in the astrophysical spectrum of the ecology of consciousness. Every element will have its own registry within that spectrum of light, and one can take starlight and learn to fractionate it, learn to make an astrophysical instrument. The first instrument to be made like that was called a spectroheliograph. It was made by an American, George Elroy Hale. He made it literally in his garage, his father's garage, in his backyard, and that their yard backed up to the new campus of the University of Chicago. And George Elroy Hale became the first head of the Department of Astronomy because even as a young man, he knew how to do something no one had ever done before. The development of astrophysics is many orders beyond the development of someone like a Copernicus or a Galileo. They're still working with phenomenality. Hale was working with a differential consciousness that he was able to take and do the visioning, make it prismatic as an art, make it historical as a kaleidoscopic development, and bring it into the science. He designed three telescopes in his life. The first was the first one for the University of Chicago. They needed to get out of the city lights. Chicago, by that time, was already so large and so many fancy lights. Chicago, they call New York the Great White Way. Where I grew up in the Midwest, Chicago was the big city. And so they located the telescope at Williams Lake, Wisconsin, a couple of hours north out of it. Then he got the idea that the clearest air is here in Southern California, so he developed the Mount Wilson Observatory, and he got people to put enough money in. They made a 100-inch telescope instead of the littler 20-some-inch telescope at Williams Bay, Wisconsin. And then he understood that if you have a 200-inch telescope with the refinements of astrophysics material, one would be able to see the light of whole galactic structures as if they were stars and be able to fractionate that. So even though, like our galaxy, has 400 billion stars, and some are much larger than ours, one would be able to do galactic scale astrophysics. And he designed Mount Palomar, the 200-inch telescope, which was finished shortly after Hale died. And it was finished in the year that, as an asthmatic child, I was brought out to Southern California to get healthy in 1948. The person who mastered the astrophysics of Mount Wilson well enough to encourage Hale to do a 200-inch telescope and use his influence and monetary corralling of funds, that person was Edwin Hubble. And Hubble showed that even with a 100-inch, you can do galactic astrophysics, so that with a 200-inch, one would be able to do almost the entire universe of galaxies, we will be able to understand the universe. Now, of course, the more that we stretch to understand the universe, the more the universe stretched to accommodate us. And now we're hoping, because the Hubble telescope has taken us back 13 billion light years with astrophysics, we're hoping the new James Webb Space Telescope to be launched and put into not just Earth orbit, it's going to follow the Earth in its orbit at one of the Lagrange points in the orbit of the Earth, and that all of this is going to be an extraordinary event by about 2016, because the James Webb Telescope will be able to take our harmonic analysis capacity of astrophysics and stretch us out in such a way that we will be able to see not only to the ends of light, to the Big Bang, but to discern the absorption of the Big Bang back into its zero field matrix. So when someone like me says, don't worry about 2012, look forward to the celebration in 2016, it's an informed, not an opinion, not a prediction, but a future history. We need a population of human beings, of men and women, who can utilize the enormous capacities that are there before us now and are being refined. And the refining began to gain speed about 1650. What happens about that time is that time forms, which are the substrate of spatial forms, has its own kind of measurable rhythmic frequency. And it has a frequency which is somewhat complicated because it has a pair of frequencies that relate together. Like the frequencies of electricity are always related to the frequencies of magnetism. When you have a large electronic complement, you have a smaller magnetic complement. But the equation solved the other way, where you will have a small electric complement and a very large magnetic complement, and instead of electromagnetism, you now have magnetoelectric. And the magnetoelectric spectrum is about 20 billion times the frequency power of the electromagnetic spectrum. If you were a phenomenal form in the magnetoelectric spectrum, you could walk through this phenomenal universe in between the spaces of electrons and atomic nuclei and never touch them. You would be literally a holy ghost of so high an order of power that it is not imaginable on the phenomenal way. It is intuitable in brief flashes on the noumenal way, but it would be only beholdable on a third kind of space, and that third kind of space is currently called hyperspace. And that hyperspace has 10 dimensions. And its 10-dimensional form makes of it not a form, but a field, a third kind of field. So that the field of nature and the field of conscious vision are two of three fields, and one here notices an archetypal jumping power, which is about orders of ability to do and to be, jumps in three different orders consistently all the way through, not only nature, but consciousness. The electron has a higher order of energy electron called the muon, which has a third kind of electron, much higher of power, called the tau. One began in the 1940s to be able to begin to understand what a muon could do, but no one understood what a tau particle could do until the mid-1980s. Outside of Chicago in the Fermi lab, Leon Lederman and his huge staff by this time finally were able to understand this is real. It is phenomenal, but it also has a noumenal relationality and it has a higher order of incredibleness, which leads us and led them within a few months to discover the W and the Z particles as well. And all of a sudden, one had a range of harmonic analysis that teased everyone in the world that we were just a smidgen away from being able to get real for the first time, but we had to hone our consciousness to be able to get there. And that was harder than honing the technology. These presentations are meant to hone our consciousness. The reality is fast upon us. Let's enjoy the promised land. Let's take a break.